Can you tell me about the first book you bought?
So I think the very first author that I completely fell in love with was Joan Egan, who wrote an enormous amount of books. She wrote the same amount of books as Agatha Christie, but it always irritates me a wee bit because there's not a lot of young people, children, reading her work now. The first book I remember going to buy with the book token is The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, which is part of, I think it's a trilogy of books that she wrote in that collection. And I really loved it because there's a kind of historical fiction element to it, so you learn a bit about kind of history in England, but she has these fantastic female child heroes that are just so feisty and kind of believable. And up until that point, I'd been reading a lot of Enid Blyton, with all the women in them are kind of sappy, and they're, you know, more interested in having midnight feasts than going on any proper kind of an adventure. Yeah. So Joan Egan's work just really came out of the blue for me, and there's definitely a kind of mythical, maybe magic realist element to it as well that I really loved. So yeah, more people should read Joan Egan.
That sounds fantastic. So the hankering for something more started at a young age for you.
Yeah. And I guess even I was thinking about this in the last few weeks with Judith Kerr passing away 2 weeks ago now.
Yeah.
Like, my favourite book as a little kid was The Tiger Who Came to Tea. And it has really struck me recently that that is essentially a magic realist text.
Yeah.
It's about a very real world setting where along comes a big giant tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And that appealed to me so much more than the entirely fantastical stories.
Yeah.
I was never like a Narnia fan or anything like that, but I still love The Tiger Who Came to Tea. And I think my poor niece is 10 now, and I'm still forcing her to listen to it when I've written her bedtime stories.
She's like, enough about the topic.
Yeah, she's like, I'm too old for this, Auntie Jan. And I'm like, no, we're reading this one tonight.
It is brilliant, and I always find, or still find, those books, as you're saying, that everything else is very, very real, and there's this one element that's completely out there. It somehow makes it feel more real, because, like, oh, this might just happen.
Yeah, and I think it really, like, authors like Judith Kerr really tap into the child's psyche, because that's how children think. They take the building blocks of what they know from the real world, and they do something a wee bit mad with it. So very rarely, you know, I've done children's workshops in the past, very rarely do they actually create some entirely new world. They usually begin with something that they understand and is familiar to them. So I think about, I did an amazing workshop in New Zealand with Maori kids a few years back, and I had this little girl who was 8 who wrote this story about a trout going to try and buy some going out shoes for going to the disco.
That's,
and it's just, it's always stuck in my head. It's just, her imagination was incredible, but what she started with was something very familiar. She had big sisters that went out to get going out clothes, and she started with this fish that was going out for the night.
That's fantastic. And of all the animals to pick, because, like, logically I'm just trying to think, where are the shoes
exactly
going?
Yeah, well, that was part of the story, the trout was having issues with how to get the high heels on.
I love that. Actually brilliant.
Yeah.
Because you could have just picked, like, any kind of animal, you know, and it wouldn't have been as funny or as mad as the fish with the heels.
And they should all have this great, like, sound effects, like about the trike click clacking up the aisle of the bus to try and get a seat.
That is brilliant. From the mouths of babes.
Yeah.
What about then the book that taught you about friendship or family? Was there one?
Ooh, friendship or family. Gosh, that is... it's actually quite difficult. I had quite a big, quick jump from children's books to Agatha Christie.
Okay.
So I was a really, like, kind of prodigious reader and read everything in the kids section of the library. And then basically a librarian who probably wasn't thinking about what was appropriate led me to the Agatha Christie section and said, try this. So in terms of, like, family dynamics, Agatha Christie's probably not the best person to take your roles from, because they're always backbiting and trying to bump each other off.
Yeah.
But I still love Agatha Christie, and I won't hear a bad word said against her, because what I learned from her was just this... how to draw you into a story. Like, Agatha Christie books are the ones that as a child I would stay up late at night reading after I was meant to be asleep. it was about story and getting pulled into it, and you just can't stop after one chapter. And I learned a lot from that, about that, from Agatha, and also lots of different ways to kill people.
Which is always a handy skill to have in life.
Yeah.
What's your favourite Agatha Christie story?
Oh, so I do like And Then There Were None, because I just, like, if you think that Agatha is a nice, you know, I think a lot of us have this picture of her as the elderly Agatha Christie, where she's in her 80s and she looks very docile. Yeah. And we forget that she wrote for 50 years, and, you know, she was a beautiful, virile young woman at one stage. And when I read And Then There Were None, I'm like, gosh, she was pretty vicious as well.
Yeah.
I mean, she stopped at nothing. She killed children quite often.
She had no mercy.
No, and she killed people in really, really awful, horrible, twisted ways. So I love it. I love Roger Ackroyd, because I think in terms of writing narrators, Roger Ackroyd is the ultimate kind of unreliable narrator. And I come back to teach him often. But yeah, there's so many of them. I'm a massive Poirot fan. And I just find Poirot really, really reassuring, because there's a kind of moral justice that runs through a lot of Agatha Christie's work. George Orwell wrote an essay on a good English murder way back at the kind of beginning of the last century, and he talked about this idea of a good English murder actually restores calm and order, because justice is always done and the
served.
Yeah, whereas the, you know, the tenets of noir is that evil happens just for evil's sake, and it leads you to think that society is out of control. And I guess Poirot to me is that ultimate symbol of order and decency and calm, like that he would stop to fix his moustache and look really well.
Presentable.
Yeah, before he goes in to deal with this heinous crime.
Yeah.
So I find him very, very comforting. And I, you know, if I'm off doing book festivals and I'm far away from home and I'm in some grotty travel lodge and feeling a bit lonely, I will quite often put a wee Poirot on iPlayer, and just makes me feel like the world's
calm,
okay.
Comforted.
Yeah.
That is so true, though. And even if you think of people who maybe as children didn't grow up reading the Agatha Christie's but might be more familiar with it from the television and film adaptations, there's such a comfort in that familiarity and structure and order to the world. There's a certain way of doing things, and it's quite lovely, as you say, that, and the rebalancing of the scales in each of in the story. There's an injustice, but then that's resolved justly.
And I mean, even like Curtin, the final Poirot, he has to sacrifice himself because there is no way for him to actually put the criminal who he knows is guilty away without sacrificing himself. And that, when the final Suchet adaptation of Poirot went out, we had a wake in our house for Poirot night, and we lit some candles for him and everything. And I just find those last scenes really, really moving. And I know he's a TV detective and he's a fictional character, but just, he is a kind of symbol of everything that's right in the world. And he's a wee bit pompous as well.
I love that. That's kind of what makes him endearing as well. I think it's amazing. We also, as a society, I think have this insatiable appetite and interest in criminals and criminality. Like, even if you look at now, people's obsession with line of duty. You know, we love figuring things out and who's doing what and who's good and who's bad. And I think it helps us make sense of the world around us.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, it teaches me a lot about the investment that a writer puts in the reader. So for me, as I am still an insatiable reader, I do about 200 books a year, and the thing that puts me off a book quicker than anything else is being patronised. And there's something about good crime fiction that invests a lot in the reader. Like, oh, you're smart enough to work this out.
You're going to figure this out.
Yeah, I don't have to tell you everything. And the best crime fiction is like that. It's why, you know, can't watch that much of Midsummer Murders.
Yes,
it just after a while, I'm like, I'm smarter than this. Yeah. I can get it.
I'm very heavy-handed here, and I'm not drunk watching you, so I can get this. What about then, and I touched on it a little bit there with the Poirot, right? What about the book that broke your heart?
Oh,
that could either be you know, because it was so frustrating or had a bad ending or character, whatever reason. Like, I always find if you're a big reader, there are just books that just break your heart at some point.
For me, I definitely know what this one is, and it's Wuthering Heights, which is a very dangerous book to present to 17-year-old girls.
Yes.
But we did Wuthering Heights for A-level, and I went to an all-girls school, and we had a very charismatic English teacher that used to read these long passages from Wuthering Heights, and it was a bit kind of Dead Poets kind of thing, and we would have these, like, conversations about the nature of love and unrequited love and all sorts of things, and I did meet up with him again later on when my book came out, and I said, oh, you know, I really loved those when you would just come in and read to us and we would talk and it was great. And he said, oh, those are the mornings whenever I was too tired and I hadn't done a lesson. And it was like a little bubble burst. But I still love Wuthering Heights, and it's probably the most read book on my bookshelves, because for one thing, it's just visionary. Like, this idea that Bronte was writing about these really kind of carnal desires and death and passion, and in what I see as a very pristine era. And she's been quite honest about things like, you know, women's passion and just how far people would go for love and hate. And I find that really, really intriguing. And I guess it probably cost her a lot to write like that as well. And I also just, as a writer, I keep coming back to it as it's amazing to me that she crafted these characters. They're just iconic. Like Heathcliff and Kathy, you just say Heathcliff, and if you don't have the perception of the cartoon cat, then you have this instant idea of this ferocious, angry man. They're brilliant. She was visionary.
No, it's a fantastic novel. And what was it particularly that broke your heart about it? Was it Kathy and Heathcliff's relationship?
I think it was just, and I always say this as a joke, like if you first man that you fall in love with is Heathcliff, then you're pretty screwed for the rest of your life. But I just remember just being really attracted to him and thinking, oh crap, that's what men are like they're really inspiring and wonderful and passionate and also really, really messed up. And I mean, it obviously is an extreme example of what men are like, but you know, at 17 when I was writing that, I was probably going through my first, you know, big passions outside of fiction. And I remember taking a lot of my learning about that from Heathcliff, which is probably not a good idea as well.
I think that was a typical thing though teenagers did with Wuthering Heights. Like, I did the same thing. I thought, you know, Heathcliff and Kathy's love is incredible. I remember giving a card to a teenage boyfriend at the time, like literally quoting the book on it, you know, and you look back now and you cringe. But you're in such an intense period of feelings, and the feelings in that book are so intensely wound. You just can't help.
It's quite a teenage book, and I don't mean that like as a negative thing, but they're, you know, it's without the kind of filters that we put on adult relationships. Like, I mean, I was actually I did an event about Kate Bush there a few weeks ago, and I reread her biography, and I was actually really disappointed. Like, her interest in Wuthering Heights didn't come from the book, it came from the film.
No, really?
So she hadn't read the book when she wrote Wuthering Heights. She'd just seen the film version.
That actually makes me so sad.
I know, it made me really sad, because I think a lot of Kate Bush's early work, when she was in her late teens, I was like, oh, she was coming from the same place as me. Yeah.
She did not get it.
No. I mean, she was reading lots of other intense literature, but...
She's so famous for the song with her in Heights and the whole video and everything. You would think,
I'd imagine she's gone back and read it since then.
I hope so now. I will send her one of my 50-minute copies I have, so I have this really weird thing that if I see Wuthering Heights out in like a charity bookshop or a secondhand shop, I have to pick it up.
Yeah.
So it's resulted in me, like, because obviously people get rid of it all the time, of all these ridiculous copies of the same book.
There's some great 70s ones as
There's that, like, the covers keep me going for alone. So I've tried to trim over the years, because it's like my other half is just like, you have 20 copies of the same book now, this is getting ridiculous. But I'll send her a copy if she wants, if she still hasn't.
I actually have this really weird story where my friend is a music photographer and we end up doing a music shoot with Justin Thingy from Bon Iver. And I happen to have a copy of Wuthering Heights in my pocket, like in my bag. And we end up talking about literature and he was like, I've never read Wuthering Heights. And I was like, hold on. So I gave my copy of Wuthering Heights to your man from Bon Iver. Don't know if he's read it or not. He's quite an intense writer, so I'd like to think I'm directly responsible for that second album.
I would take that. Take that and ask him for your acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Now, so then what about, is there a book that you've read that's made you know yourself a little better?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a book, it's an author, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
But, but she didn't write very many books, so Flannery O'Connor is the person for me.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I really kind of wish I could get to meet her and say thank you for everything she's done for me. I guess if the first I came to Flannery O'Connor through the short stories, A Good Man Is Hard to Find, that collection, and then devoured all four of her books. I really love Wise Blood. It's a novel I come back to quite a lot. It's kind of a bit like Emily Bronte. I think she was visionary ahead of her time. Like, there's a brutality to Flannery O'Connor's writing that just doesn't, it sits awkwardly with her Catholicism, but I think from my perspective it sits in a really comfortable place. Like, faith has been a huge part of my journey, and I had always thought I had to keep it separate from my work, and discovering Flannery and how her Catholicism fed her work and also was something that she reacted against in her work in a very, it's a respectful reaction. So she's not critiquing for the sake of being critical, she's critiquing what needs to be critiqued about religion. And that's been a theme that has come up over and over for me as I began to write. And I don't know, I got a lot of reassurance from Flannery. And she's an unswervering writer as well. She didn't have much else going on in her life. She was, you know, I've read everything that she's ever written. And as far as I can see, she was never really in love. She didn't travel much. She mostly lived in her wee farm with her peacocks, and her mum was probably the most influential person in her life. And yet she knew what she was on the planet to do, and it was to write books. And she was crawling out of her deathbed to do the edits in some of her last work because that's what she was on the planet to do. And I've always found that really inspiring. I guess I'm quite a driven person, and you know, writing to me is the most important thing, and a lot of people don't understand that. A drive like that can sometimes make you a hard person, but with someone like Flannery, it didn't. She had her focus, but there's a generosity around the edges of her. So her letters, there's massive, almost 1,000-page collection of letters that she wrote to other younger writers, encouraging them and dialoguing with them about her work. And so she was driven, but she was also human and warm and generous. And I guess I probably have her in a bit of a pillar, and if I met her I'd be like, oh, she wasn't that nice really, was she?
Catch her on a bad day.
Yeah, I mean, she was vitriolic as well. Yeah. Like, some of her comments about her contemporaries, she didn't suffer fools at all. Like, didn't like Capote at all.
Well, in fairness, with the benefit of hindsight, I think we can all look back and go, yeah, it wasn't that great.
So, yeah, there are things about her which I just, I'm probably going to keep coming back to for the rest of my life. I'm quite glad that there's only four books, because with the obsession that I have, if I had an obsession with somebody that had a massive 50-book canon, it would be exhausting.
It would.
And I also, when I'm in a charity shop, if I see a Flannery O'Connor with a different cover, I have to go and buy it.
Pick it up.
Yeah.
I actually haven't read any of her work, and I really want to.
I would recommend Wise Blood. Is tiny. It's like very thin. Just about a novel, but it's kind of tottering on the edge of novella. And like, A Good Man Is Hard to Find, that collection is probably the best one. There's a story in it called Good Country People, which is amazing.
Okay.
Amazing.
I love that though, and that thing you were saying about you being quite a driven person as well. I think as a writer you have to be, because you have to be driven to sit down and actually create the work and put out the work. And people are multifaceted, and I think maybe the person you are when you're writing is very different to the person you are outside, and you're like, you know, it's a labor and a commitment to make it, you know, it's as big as having children, like it sucks up your time and you're forever going to be associated with it.
And I think that's a really interesting point you make, Vicky, about the differentiation between the writer on the page and the writer in person. And I've had a lot of people say that to me. Like, I did an interview with a Chinese journal last year, and one of the questions was, in real life you are actually a nice, happy person, why on the paper are you so depressed and angry?
Oh, you're kidding me.
Which I can kind of see that,
but like,
and like, I think writers quite often live in two worlds. So there's the internal world inside your head, which is probably much closer to what comes out on paper, and then there's like the, you know, external world where you're interacting with people and you're trying to express your ideas in a fumbly kind of club-footed sort of way. I'm definitely much better on paper than I am talking to people, but
I can deny that completely.
And it's funny, like, I've been really lucky, and I've met some of my hero writers in the last wee while, and a lot of them are, they're not what you think they're going to be.
They never are. And like, most of the time they're better. You've almost created a caricature version of them in your mind.
Which makes me wonder if, you know, the likes of Oscar Wilde, was he that witty all the time?
I think so. Like, you can't put your video on 24/7. Like, even the most glam person has a day when they're in their sweats. I'm just not feeling it, and I'm just going to like sit here and read a book and drink a whiskey.
Or you want to have a chat about what you watched on Netflix last night rather than, you know, some big philosophical concept.
And did he just not talk then if he wasn't coming out with something incredibly... Just
silent for 4 minutes, then said something you could put on a fridge magnet, and then was silent for the rest of the hour.
Oh, God. Okay, so then what about the book that taught you about either grief or loss?
Ooh, grief or loss. Let me think for a wee sec.
I'm
flicking through my favourites. I think, and he's another essentially really important writer for me because I love everything he's written. But one of the big books for me in the last few years has been George Saunders' Lincoln and the Bardo. And George, I just think, I think he's the best writer on the planet who's alive. And I'm just always undone by the way he can kind of hold both kind of humour and pathos in the same sentence. And I think the short stories, I've already always seen that in his short stories. Like, I love, there's a short story in 10th of December called The Simply Good Girl Diaries. And there's a tiny line in it that I always draw people's attention to. And I'm going to paraphrase it really badly here. But the main character pulls up to his house and he says, in kind of like that George Saunders very staccato way, you know, came home, felt sad, looked at house, thought, if sad will make everyone else sad, went in happy. And that is hilarious, but it's also tragic as well, because that's how most people live their lives. They have a sense of how they're really feeling inside, and then they have a sense of the image that they have to project, and they go with that. And so there's always something a wee bit kind of absent within them. And I guess that I've been following George since he first started writing, and that has always been there in his work. But when Lincoln came out, in the Bardo came out, it just, because it's a novel, it's longer form, there's more time spent on the depth of the characters, because Lincoln to me is already a really, I find him a really inspiring person. I'm that terrible person that cries in the cinema at anything that's about kind of self-sacrifice and heroism. And I bawled my eyes out at the Lincoln movie. So I just love that he stood for ideals, and he was flawed as well, and he was honest about his flaws. And all that is in that book, alongside absurdism and humour. And there's, I don't want to spoil it, but there's a section near the end when Lincoln leaves the graveyard, and I was in floods. Like, it just, it ruined me. He's a genius that he can do that. I've been really fortunate. I've got to hear him read 3 times, and I heard him the first time I heard him read, he read from the Simplica Girl Diaries, and I watched 2 middle-aged ladies sat beside me laughing really hard and then start to cry within about a paragraph of that. And I think it's not learning about sorrow and loss, it's learning about what it means to be human, that the both ends of the spectrum are held in tension all the time. And Saunders does that because he is a good human being who writes from a place of compassion. You can tell that when he talks in his essays and his non-fiction work. He is generous, he's wise, and he's kind. And I love that when there was a lot of critique about American culture in the last few years, he has always started from a place of asking himself, how am I complicit in this awful thing that's happening, before you criticise other people. And I know he has a background in Buddhism and some of that comes from there, but I really think if a lot of our leaders and decision makers started from that place of how am I complicit, we would be beginning from a much more compassionate, humane place.
It shouldn't be such a radical thought, but it is.
No.
This idea of evaluating your own
acts
and the ways. And I mean, you can do it on a macro or micro level.
Yeah.
Something as simple as, like, you know, white people only understanding in recent years about white privilege. Like,
yeah.
That kind of thing of awareness and waking up. And
yeah.
That's incredibly powerful.
Oh, George Saunders, I just think, is amazing. I wish he could be in charge of America.
If only.
Yeah. Probably the best literary event I have ever sat in was it was in America in the Midwest about 3 years ago, and it was Tobias Wolff, short story writer, Tobias Wolff in conversation with George Saunders. And Tobias Wolff is a similar humane, kind, wise writer, and he was George Saunders' professor at Syracuse, so he taught Saunders to write, and they were talking about the relationship between teacher and learner. And it was food for the soul.
Yeah.
It was as much about how to craft a sentence as it was about how to be a decent human being.
So then I think I'm going to bring us on to, and there's probably a few we've talked about
that would
fit into this category, but the book that you read again and again.
Ooh. Do you know, it's a weird one, and a lot of people maybe don't know it.
I love
but,
weird ones.
The writer Richard Brodigan. So Richard Brodigan was a kind of beat writer on the West Coast. He wrote quite a number of very short novels. There's one called The Abortion, which I really love, which is about a couple travelling from America down to Tijuana to have an abortion. And it's a kind of metaphor for the whole of America. But there's the first Richard Brodigan book that I ever read is called Trout Fishing in America. And a friend of mine, when I was living in the States, and I'd just begun writing, I'd probably been writing for about 2 years, and was writing very weird stuff and didn't know where it was coming from. And this friend pressed a very battered copy of Trout Fishing into my hand and said, I think you need to read this. And it was like all the lights came on at the one time. It's a tiny little book. I think it's about 75 pages long, and it's somewhere between prose and poetry. And Brodigan uses trout fishing in America as a metaphor for just about everything.
Oh,
so
wow.
Trout fishing in America represents politics and class distinction and the war. And he was writing, you know, in the period of Vietnam and around then. And I just learned a lot from that book about language and how flexible language and metaphor is.
Yeah.
And like Brodigan has a very finely tuned sense of absurdism. There's a lot of kind of Vonnegut's work plays with, and another writer called Donald Antrim. And they all do that thing where they stretch the metaphor so far, it almost implodes, but they hold on to it. And Trout Fishing became a book that I go back to almost yearly, just to see what you can do with language. And I think, you know, for me, and I say this a lot, and it's beginning to feel a bit like a thing you write in a fridge magnet, but I've learned that a sentence has to do 2 things. Prose writers quite often get obsessed with the meaning of a sentence, like that it conveys your plot or your character or whatever. Poets they're, you know, it's about the lyricality and the flow and the imagery. To me, a sentence has to mean and it also has to sing at the same time. And I learned that from Brodigan. He's a really interesting character as well.
It's brilliant. And those books as well, that each time you go back, you kind of soak up something new from it in a way as well.
I think I've been thinking about this a lot recently. I listened to Will Eaves, who just won the Welcome Prize there, but a month ago he was doing a talk in the north about a month ago, and he talked about how memory isn't a static thing. Memory changes with your kind of life experience. So, you know, you have a memory of your parents fighting whenever you were younger. You don't entirely understand that until you are an adult in an adult relationship and you look back with understanding and context. I think it's the same with books. So, for example, we talked about Agatha Christie earlier. There are family dynamics and adult relationships in Agatha Christie books that I did not understand when I was a child. Like, 8-year-olds shouldn't understand what incest is.
Yeah.
That would be a very bad thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, you read it again when you're in your 30s and you see things because of the life experience you've got now. And I think it's the same with language. Like, I think quite often we become obsessed with trying to read all of the trendy books and the things you're meant to read. And I made a conscious decision 2 years ago to let the books lead me.
Yes.
And, you know, if I have 4 or 5 conversations where Alice Munro comes up or I hear her mentioned on the radio, I should probably read some Alice Munro now.
Yeah.
And I have found that kind of, you know, relaxed, less uptight way of reading has just, I don't know, it has been better for me in terms of not being comparing myself with other writers, but I've also found that I'm learning things at the right time in my life when I'm ready to engage with them.
You have to come to it either at a particular point in your life or with a particular prism of experience or lens behind it as well. And like, the worst thing you can do is force yourself to read something and not get it. And I had that previously, and I feel like I'm stupid, you know, that I was missing out on something that I'm not getting everyone else for. And it's only as I've gotten older that I went, it's just not for me, or it's not for me right now.
Yeah, and it works the other way as well, because I've reread books recently that were really important to me back in the day, kind of thing, and I've even come across bits that I've underlined and gone, why the hell did I underline that? Like, that's really obvious.
Yeah.
And like, you can grow out of books as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which that's very scary to say as a writer, that your readers might grow out of your books.
Though, like, this is such a strange example, but I know I was and still am a big fan of John Green, who's a YA author, right? But the connection and intensity which I felt towards his book in my late teens, as opposed to my like late 20s now, is very different. And like that, you know, I've gone back through passages I underlined, oh god, I thought these were so true and so searing at the time, and it's because of where you were and in that moment they were. But then you get older and life happens, and you know, things become a bit more nuanced. And now I find, like, I read Maggie O'Farrell's memoir, You Know I Am, I Am, I Am, and like, yes, this is just full of so many truths. Whereas if I'd read that probably when I was younger, well, it wasn't out then, but if I'd been younger when I was out, probably would have been like, I don't really get this. Well, you know, it doesn't resonate as much with me. So it's interesting how you grow and the books around you grow with you.
Yeah. And then there are some that you just hold on to your whole life and you just keep peeling them and seeing more layers in them.
Like an onion.
Yeah.
The book onion.
Yeah.
we're actually kind of coming a little bit to the end now, so I wanted to chat with you about the, I know you're extremely busy and you're going to have a lot of travelling coming up. What are the next books you're hoping to read or you're excited about reading?
I have got the new Kevin Barry in my backpack. I'm interviewing Kevin in about a month's time, so I'm going to read that soonish, and I'm very excited about the Ocean Vuong one that everyone is talking about. I don't think it's quite out yet, so I know I said I've stopped reading trendy books, but there's a difference between things being, you know, current and things just being trendy.
Yeah.
Like, both of those writers are amazing, and I'm excited about those. I'm also super, super excited about, I'm kind of obsessed with an American writer called Karen Russell.
Okay.
That very few people here seem to know, but she wrote a short story collection called St. Lizzie's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves about 10 years ago that just blew my mind. And this will be her fourth or fifth book since then. So it's not out here yet, but if anybody is coming from America to Ireland in the next few while, I would pay enormous amounts of money to get it. So I'm excited about that. And then the world has been trying to get me to read Madame Bovary all
the
year.
The world has?
Yeah. So everywhere I've gone, there's been Madame Bovary references.
Oh, really?
And I feel dreadful that I've got to nearly 40 and I've never read it. So that will be something that I delve into over the summer. And then I guess next year I'm really, really excited. I've been given a big chunk of funding to look at representation of dementia in literature. So I have just bought myself what I'm calling my dementia bookcase.
Okay.
So it's a little blue bookcase that is just full of books, either fiction that has characters with dementia or books about the mind and memory and neurology.
Okay.
So over the summer, I'm going to be reading a lot of books about dementia.
That's incredible.
And then I've got some space in August. I've got a month's residency in Scotland, so I'm going to be writing in response to some of those books.
Yeah.
So I'm quite excited about the ideas that will be sparked from that, because, you know, I've long since got past where I just read for entertainment. I'm always reading as a writer and just hoping that wee things will spark. And not that you're stealing someone's idea, but there's quite often a line or a concept that jumps out of a book and you think, gosh, you know, at the minute I'm writing a short story and it was a small idea that jumped out of the pages of a Deborah Levy book I was reading a few weeks back, and a whole short story came to mind really quickly. So those are always gifts when that happens.
It is, and it hugely changes when you're a writer as well. I've said this to my other half actually around the talk about the other day. I never feel guilty for spending time reading books or watching films or TV programs, because for me that's all feeding back towards my creativity. And it's not that you're stealing, as you say, but you see something and it riffs off something and you get an idea. And I mean, obviously not all the TV I watch is creative for the soul. I mean, Kardashians is not doing anything for my writing, but at the same time, like, a lot of the art and media you consume, when you do that as a writer or as that your job, the relationship with that then changes. And then I find, I very specific books that I know this book, I'm not looking for, you know, it's kind of trashy, like, but it's good trashy, and that's just for relaxation. But everything else, I mean, there's certain books I can't read at night time because I know I'll be scribbling a notebook somewhere. Oh, that's so good. It's such a, like that. Yeah. And it ties into that.
And I think it's how you posture yourself as well. So I'm teaching a 8-week course on the novel at the minute, and I was telling my students last night that you need to posture yourself to be open to ideas. Like, you know, a lot of people, particularly with TV and film, they don't watch TV and film with the same head that they read a book. Whereas to me, you're always a writer. Like, when I go to the cinema, I'm going as a writer, and I'm looking at character development, and I'm looking at how, you know, to me, film in particular is a really condensed version of story. And it's quite obvious on screen when you start to see kind of how the director is pulling things out and developing the story. But you have to go in with your eyes open, or all of that just goes over your head.
Yeah, such a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
And that is such a wonderful way to end the episode. So, Jan Carson, thank you so very, very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.